gone, I started wondering if Rothschild might have had a hand in what happened to the poor girl. I take it she overheard something in his house she wasn't meant to hear. The old man nodded. It's frightening, isn't it? The simple, seemingly inconsequential decisions we make that can shift the entire course of our lives. She went to use the water closet after her lesson with the child, and was coming down the stairs when she heard Rothschild consulting with one of his men. I suppose he thought she had gone. There was little in Jane's world beyond music, and her boys, of course, when they were alive. So she didn't know the background of what she was hearing. I suspect if Rothschild had simply smiled at her and let her go on her way, she probably wouldn't have given it another thought. What did he do instead? He came the ugly, threatened her with all sorts of dire repercussions if she told anyone, and then ordered her never to come near his house again. Sheridan shook his head. The man might be a wonder when it comes to manipulating markets and turning this nasty war to his advantage, but he's a poor judge of people. He thought he was frightening her, and he did frighten her, but he also put up her back. She went home, thought about it all for a while, then came to ask me to explain it to her. So Rothschild knew all about the gold guineas hidden aboard the Viking. The old man gave a rude snort. Of course he knew. He's been smuggling gold out of England for years. Last December alone he shipped something like 400,000 guineas worth. Good God, said Sebastian. The exportation of gold from Britain had been illegal for almost 20 years, ever since a disastrous run on gold stocks that took place shortly before the turn of the century. At the same time Parliament outlawed gold exports, they'd also made it illegal for the Bank of England to issue gold coins, forcing them to use only non-convertible paper notes. The problem is, Sheridan was saying, thanks to this blasted war, the value of the pound has been going down at the same time the price of gold has skyrocketed. It's a situation ripe for gold speculators. And the most successful speculator of them all is Nathan Rothschild. He buys gold in London with devalued British banknotes and then sells it on the continent at a profit of 20% or more. How patriotic. Sheridan huffed a scornful laugh. Oh, he's that all right. And he's not the only one, not by a long shot. Look at the Hope's Bank. They helped arrange the bloody loans that enabled the United States to buy Louisiana from France, thus injecting millions of pounds into Napoleon's war efforts against us. How is that not treason? How? If there were any justice in this world, the lot of them would be tried and hanged. Instead, their descendants will be wealthy beyond the wildest dreams of avarice, while the poor women and children of this land starve in the streets. And their menfolk are used for cannon fodder. Speculators always manage to profit from war. Yes, but this goes beyond mere speculation. What's most disturbing about that gold shipment on the Viking is where it was headed. Rothschild used to send most of his gold to Amsterdam, Vienna, and Frankfurt. Now, it's all going to France. The shipment on the Viking was only one of many he sent there this month. He has agents stationed at Gravelines to collect it and quickly send it directly to his brother in Paris. You told this to Jane? The old man let out his breath in a pained sigh. Some of it. I didn't know it all at the time. I had to look into it a bit. Do you think Jane might have told someone else about what she heard? I did warn her not to. So why do you blame yourself for what happened to her? Sheridan squinted over at him. How do you know I do? Ambrose said he heard you mumbling to yourself as you walked away. Ah. The old man rasped one hand across his beard-roughened chin. I warned her not to tell anyone about what she'd heard, but it occurs to me that in the process of looking into it, I may have accidentally betrayed her. I mean, Rothschild knows I'm her uncle. What if someone told him I was poking around, asking questions? The man could easily have put two and two together. And had her killed? Sharon shook his head, although it was in uncertainty and confusion rather than in denial. I don't know. Would he do that, do you think?
You said he threatened her.
Threatened her with what? He said if she breathed a word about what she'd heard, he'd break every bone in her body.
That sounds pretty specific to me.
Sheridan looked up at him with troubled, bloodshot eyes. Yes, it does, doesn't it? Chapter 33. The brightness of the sun bouncing off the snow-covered pavement hurt Sebastian's eyes as he drove toward the city, guiding his horses through treacherously icy streets, past silent shops draped with glistening icicles, and half-buried behind piles of shoveled snow. The sun might be out, but there was no warmth in it, and the few people he saw were bundled up and walking briskly. The air was cold and still, the smoke from the city's chimneys rising straight up to smudge the blue sky. He could hear the squeaking crunch of the chestnut's hooves in the snow, and the bark of a dog somewhere in the distance, the sound carrying with unnatural clarity. But all the normal racket and bustle were eerily absent, as if London were as frozen and unmoving as its river. He was only vaguely aware of the silent, snow-plastered facades sliding past, the classical pilasters, bow windows, and pediments of Mayfair, giving way to the soot-grimed red brick of an earlier age as he neared the financial district. There was a heaviness in his heart, an ache that was part sorrow, but also part anger. He felt an absurd, useless wish to reach back in time to that fateful Thursday afternoon and stop Jane Ambrose as she crossed the ancient brick courtyard of Warwick House, with the snow falling around her. If only he could call her name, or somehow turn her away from whatever she was walking into. Where had she been headed that day? He wondered for what felt like the thousandth time. To see Rothschild? Why then in such dreadful weather? How had she then ended up in Clerkenwell? Where? Why? How? He understood Jane better now, but he knew he still wasn't seeing her clearly, for she was more than a grieving mother mourning her lost children. More than a deeply unhappy wife married to a profligate, abusive man who claimed her glorious music as his own. She was also the kind of person willing to stand as a loyal friend to a troubled young princess. And through no fault of her own, she had found herself in possession of dangerous information about powerful, ruthless men. Nathan Rothschild was striding up the narrow medieval lane of St. Swithin, the hem of his worn greatcoat flaring in the bitter wind, when Sebastian fell into step beside him. The financier cast him one swift glance, then stared straight ahead. His pace never slackened, despite the treacherous, icy footing. Sebastian said, "I've discovered a few things since our last conversation."
"Oh? And do you expect me to applaud your cleverness?"
"Not yet." Rothschild grunted. Sebastian said, "According to my sources, you've been smuggling hundreds of thousands of guineas a month to the continent for years, with most of it going to Napoleon's old allies. But the gold that was found aboard the Viking on the 3rd of January was bound for France itself. For bloody Paris."
"I take it this shocks you."
"On the 4th of January, you were discussing the Viking's interception with one of your agents, when you realized your daughter's piano instructor was still in the house and had overheard everything you said. That is why you dismissed her. It's also why she was afraid, because you threatened to break every bone in her body."
Rothschild drew up abruptly and swung to face him, pale eyes glittering with animosity.
You are dabbling in affairs about which you know nothing, nothing.
True.
But I'm slowly discovering more and more.
Yet you still obviously have much to learn.
Why do you think the Vikings' captain and crew were let go?
For the same reason your crews are always released. You bribe someone. The financier cast a quick look around the snowy street before leaning in close and lowering his voice.
The shipment aboard the Viking was indeed headed for Gravelines, from whence it would have been sent on to Paris. But what you do not seem to understand is that its ultimate destination was Wellington's army in the Pyrenees.
Wellington? Sebastian stared at him for one incredulous moment, then threw back his head and laughed.
Rothschild's jaw tightened.
You laugh, but it is true. That shipment was simply the first part of £600,000 bound for Wellington, so that he may meet his payroll and pay the Spanish and French merchants for his army's needs.
I don't believe you.
Rothschild gave a dismissive shrug.
Ask your own father. He is the Chancellor of the Exchequer, after all. He was there when the agreements were signed.
Then why all the lies?
Why do you think?
Transactions of this nature are complicated and require great secrecy.
Do you seriously imagine that Napoleon would allow the transfers to continue if he knew their ultimate destination?
Sebastian studied the financier's homely, undecipherable face.
Did you kill Jane Ambrose?
I did not.
I don't believe you.
And you think that should concern me?
Rothschild started to turn away, but Sebastian put out a hand, stopping him.
What about Jarvis? Did you tell him that Jane Ambrose knew about the shipments to Paris?
I did.
So it's possible he killed her?
Rothschild glanced toward the exchange as the bells in the clock tower began to chime, ringing out, "Lo, see the conquering hero comes."
Many things are possible. All I know is you are delaying me. Good day to you, sir.
And with that he strode off, a stout, homely man in threadbare clothing, with the morals of a cutpurse, and wealth that could beggar kings. Chapter 34.
It pains me to have to admit it,
said Hendon, as he and Sebastian walked beneath the rows of snow-shrouded plane trees in St. James's Park.
But Rothschild is telling the truth.
Sebastian looked over at him.
You can't be serious. I wish I weren't. You'll never convince me there wasn't another way to get that money to Wellington, a way that wouldn't have included Rothschild pocketing nearly four times as much as Wellington is receiving.
How much?
You heard me. Rothschild is earning £2 million out of the transaction. That's obscene. Oh, yes, without a doubt.
Hendon paused, his jaw tightening as he stared out over the snowy, undulating park.
The people of England are freezing and starving to death by the tens of thousands, and this man is being paid a premium to do what he's been doing against our laws in secret for years. The entire damn family has grown enormously rich by financing both sides of this interminable war, and now Jarvis has given their London representative the opportunity to pretend he's a patriot.
Hendon huffed a mirthless laugh.
If he were a patriot, he'd be transferring the money for nothing rather than making a fortune out of it.
And Napoleon suspects nothing?
Hendon shook his head.
Napoleon may be a brilliant military strategist, but he has a soldier's understanding of finance. He doesn't believe in either paper money or government debt, and he's convinced that a country's economy is only strong when it has strong gold reserves. That's why he's been willing to allow his bankers to cooperate with London's gold speculators. He's convinced that Rothschild, and those like him, are weakening England.
But they are, aren't they?
They are. Although not as much as Napoleon believes.
Hendon walked on in silence,
his hands clasped behind his back, his face troubled.
You think Rothschild killed that woman? It's looking increasingly likely, either Rothschild or Jarvis. Jarvis more likely. The Rothschilds might keep one of our age's greatest intelligence networks, but I don't think they're anywhere near as fond of assassins as your father-in-law. They might make an exception for someone who threatened a windfall of £2 million.
True.
Hendon sighed. It's a damnable business, this war financing. I've heard Napoleon likes to say that when a government depends on bankers, the bankers control the government. I fear I'm beginning to agree with him.
Only the beginning, said Sebastian.
And the Earl looked over at him and laughed. A light snow was falling again by the time Sebastian climbed the hill to Brook Street. He found Hero sitting cross-legged on the hearthrug before the library fire, her head bowed as she focused on petting Mr. Darcy, who lay curled up nearby.
"They hanged her?"
Sebastian asked quietly, going to pour himself a brandy. Hero nodded. "Along with a man and his two boys. It was beyond ghastly. How can anyone possibly watch something like that for fun?"
"I don't know, but tens of thousands do."
She rested her hands on her knees as the cat stood and stretched. "Surely you haven't been at the inquest all this time?" He shook his head.
"The inquest was little more than a formality."
He came to sit in one of the upholstered armchairs beside her and told her of his discussions with Ambrose, Sheridan, and Rothschild. "And Hendon confirmed this," she said when he had finished.
"He did."
She stared at the fire beside her. "Jarvis's name keeps coming up, first with regard to Orange, and now this."
"It does. But then, little of importance happens in this kingdom that he's not involved with, in one way or another."
"You think he killed her?"
Sebastian hesitated, then said,
"It's certainly a possibility."
"Dear God."
She pushed to her feet and went to stare out the window at the quietly falling snow.
"You've spoken to him?"
"Not yet."
"I will," she said.
He felt a heavy weight of sadness settle over him. Hero's love for her father was deep and powerful, and Sebastian wasn't sure what it would do to her if she were to discover Jarvis's hand at work in this. But all he could say was,
"If that's what you want."
She turned her head to meet his gaze, her eyes dark and hurting.
"It's what I want."
Jarvis was seated at the elegant French desk in his chambers in Carlton House when Hero arrived. According to his clerk, he'd only recently returned from the Foreign Office and was reading a report from Castlereagh, but he set the papers aside at the sight of her. "I know about the gold, Rothschild, and Jane Ambrose," she said without preamble. He leaned back in his chair.
"Oh?"
"That's why you sent your carriage for her several weeks ago, isn't it? Not because she was spying for you, but because she had accidentally stumbled upon the details of the gold transfers through the Rothschilds. You had her brought here so that you could threaten her, scare her."
"Under the circumstances, do you blame me?"
Hero went to stand with her back to the window, her gaze on his face. "Our warships control the channel. You'll never convince me you couldn't send that gold directly to Spain."
"To Spain, yes. But Wellington is over the Pyrenees and into France now. The French bankers are insisting on heavily discounting our government notes to such an extent that Wellington was getting desperate. Sending the gold through Paris was easier, quicker, and believe it or not, cheaper."
"Cheaper?"
"Yes, cheaper. These things are complicated."
"Obviously."
She kept her gaze hard on his face. "You told me you didn't kill her, and I believed you." Jarvis pushed to his feet.
"As it happens, I did not kill her. I won't deny that if I had felt it necessary to eliminate her, I would have done so. But I had no reason to kill her. She had already told her Uncle Sheridan about the gold, but I convinced her that she would be signing the death warrant of anyone else who heard about it from her. She wisely saw the importance of keeping quiet.
So who did kill her?
I've no idea.
Rothschild? Jarvis shrugged.
It's possible.
But you don't care.
Is there a reason I should?
She watched him walk over to pour wine into two glasses. I've heard it said. Rothschild brags that whoever controls Britain's money supply controls the kingdom. And you and I both know that he controls Britain's money supply. Jarvis smiled.
Rothschild is an extraordinarily clever, ruthless, and unprincipled financier. But I could wipe him out just like that.
He raised one hand and snapped his fingers.
If he doesn't realize it, he's a fool.
She tipped her head to one side. So certain?
Yes.
He held out one of the glasses, and after a moment she took it. She said, someone tried to kill Devlin in Fleet Street.
So I had heard.
Was that you? Jarvis took a sip of his own wine.
He told you I warned him.
As it happens, no, he did not.
Interesting.
Hero waited a moment, then said, I noticed you didn't say it wasn't you.
Not this time.
I hope that was said in jest. Jarvis reached out to touch her cheek in a rare gesture of affection.
I did not try to kill your tiresome husband. Not yet.
He hesitated a moment, his expression vaguely troubled or perhaps simply confused.
Why do you continue to take such a personal interest in this woman's death? Simply because you happen to be the one to find her?
That's part of it, I suppose, but it's also because... She paused, searching for a way to put her thoughts into words. If I were to simply go on with my life, forgetting about her and how she died, then it would be as if I myself had had a part in killing her.
This is nonsense. You barely knew the woman.
You think that should matter? She searched his face, but found none of the reassurance she so desperately needed to see there, and gave a faint shake of her head. This is the fundamental difference between you and me, isn't it? The kingdom and its monarchy mean everything to you, and you will do anything to serve and protect them. Yet the people, the hard-working, poor, everyday people who form the bedrock of what Britain is and always has been, are to you nothing more than the coal beneath our soil or the timber in our forests, a resource to be exploited and, if necessary, destroyed.
No, I care about the people of Britain, but on an individual level, no, of course not. That would be ridiculous.
Hero shook her head. I can't understand that way of thinking.
A defect you obviously share with your husband, said Jarvis.
But at that, Hero only smiled. Chapter 35 Sebastian was cleaning his pistol at his desk when he heard a distant door slam, followed by a shout. He looked up as Tom came skidding into the room.
"I got what you wanted, Governor,"
exclaimed the tiger, ignoring Maury's loud hiss from the entrance hall.
"I've been asking around the Percy Arms about that Italian cove you're interested in, and I finally found a chambermaid says he went off about midday last Thursday. He come back for a bit to change his clothes and get his harp. But then he went off again.
Sebastian carefully replaced the pistol's flint.
She's certain about the day.
Aye, says it was the day they got their chimney swept, and the sweeps boy got stuck up the one in Vescovi's room for hours. Only Vescovi never knew it, 'cause he didn't come in till late.
A respectable 18th-century red-brick inn with white sash windows and a tidy, symmetrical façade, the Percy Arms lay on Red Lion Square in Holborn. When Sebastian pushed open the street door and turned toward the public room, a warm atmosphere, heavy with the smells of coal and tobacco smoke, roasting meat and spilled ale, enveloped him. He ordered a tankard, and then went to pull out the opposite chair of the table where Signor Valentino Vescovi sat eating a plate of sausages beside the fire. The Italian froze, with a fork halfway to his mouth.
Par l'amor de Deo. What are you doing here?
What do you think?
Said Sebastian, settling himself comfortably.
But I told you everything I know.
Sebastian took a slow sip from his tankard and set it on the table between them.
I think not.
Vescovi thrust a large chunk of sausage into his mouth and chewed in silence. Sebastian said,
You can begin by telling me where you really were last Thursday. And don't even think of trying to convince me you were here all day, because I now know that for a lie. I did warn you, did I not?
The Italian swallowed his half-chewed sausage, his eyes going wide.
Where were you?
Sebastian said again.
With the big princess, Princess Caroline of Wales, said Vescovi, his voice hoarse.
Sebastian sat back in his chair and folded his arms at his chest.
You do realize I will check, don't you?
Yes, yes, of course. But I was there, I swear it.
All afternoon and evening.
The harpist twitched one shoulder.
Late afternoon to evening. Before that, I was skating. Why so long?
Pardon?
Why were you at Connaught House so long? You were obviously there for something more than a simple music lesson.
Vescovi sat up straighter and said with an assumption of great dignity,
Her Highness was hosting a dinner party, and I provided the music.
Oh?
And who was at this dinner party?
Vescovi frowned.
I'm not convinced. I should tell you that.
Sebastian met the man's gaze and held it.
Actually, I rather think you should.
The Italian's gaze faltered away.
Broom? Henry Broom was there. Whitbread, Earl Grey, some others.
Phineas Wallace?
No, not him. He was supposed to attend, but he cancelled at the last minute.
Interesting, thought Sebastian. Aloud, he said, I've been slowly piecing together a picture of Jane Ambrose's last days. On Thursday, the 20th of January, exactly 1 week before she died, Peter van der Pals attempted to cajole Jane into spying on Princess Charlotte for him and then threatened her when she refused. The following day, she told Miss Kinsworth of the incident, unaware of the fact that the Duchess of Leeds' nasty young daughter was listening at keyholes again. So when did Lady Arabella talk to you? Vescovi slumped in his seat and looked miserable.
The following Monday. And Jane confronted you beside the canal in St. James's Park that same day?
Yes, said Vescovi again,
obviously not seeing where this was going.
Why? Because the following afternoon, Tuesday, Jane went to see a certain gentleman of her acquaintance to ask about Orange's sexual interests. So far, I haven't been able to discover who told her about Orange, but given the timing, I'm beginning to think it was you.
Sebastian hesitated.
Am I right?
Faced tight with worry, Vescovi set down his fork with a clatter and pushed his half-eaten plate away.
Sebastian said, Signor.
The Italian drew a pained breath and nodded.
I was angry. We both were. She made a number of unjust accusations about me, and I told her she was naive, that she didn't understand the situation at all. That's when you told her about Orange.
Vescovi nodded.
But she didn't believe me. At least she said she didn't.
She may not have believed you at first, but she was concerned enough about what you said that she sought out someone she thought could confirm it.
Vescovi swiped his hands down over his face.
And this person she went to see, did he tell her the truth?
He did.
Dio mio,
he whispered.
You think that's why she was killed? Because someone was afraid she might pass on what she'd learned to Charlotte?
I think it's a distinct possibility.
Dio mio,
he said again. Sebastian studied the musician's haggard, troubled face.
The Orange Alliance is important to a number of powerful people, none of whom are the sort to take kindly to having their ambitions thwarted.
Vescovi brought up a shaky hand to cup his mouth.
What? Asked Sebastian, watching him.
The musician cast a quick look around, then leaned forward and dropped his hand. Those pushing for the Orange Alliance are extraordinarily ruthless and powerful. But some of those working to prevent the marriage, while less powerful, can also be dangerous. Sebastian frowned. But Jane was against the marriage herself. Why would they be a threat to her? You must understand that those working against the Alliance do not all share the same motivations. Nor do they all have the little princess's best interests at heart. Some wish simply to protect Charlotte from a miserable future and are opposed to the marriage for that reason, while others would like to prevent the Dutch entanglement, but not at the cost of harming the princess. Yet there are those who will do anything to prevent the alliance, and they don't care if Princess Charlotte is hurt in the process. That doesn't make sense. How might she get hurt? If anything, it's in her best interests if the marriage is called off. That depends on why it's called off, does it not? Meaning, what? Please. Vescovi's voice turned into an agonized whisper. Don't ask me, I cannot tell you. Sebastian studied the other man's drawn, frightened face.
You might be safer if you did.
I cannot. And with that, the Italian pushed up from his chair and walked quickly away, his head bowed and the fingers of one hand sliding nervously up and down his watch chain. Chapter 36. Sebastian stood beside the stone balustrade of Blackfriars Bridge and stared out over the uneven, frozen plain that had once been the River Thames. Two straggly parallel lines of gaily painted booths and tents were beginning to form, with roving vendors selling everything from gingerbread and tea to gloves and hairbrushes. Troops of jugglers, acrobats, and tumblers performed for the growing crowd, while close to one of the arches of the bridge, someone was roasting a sheep over a large iron pan full of coals and charging sixpence to watch or a shilling for a slice of mutton. The air was heavy with the scent of roasting meat, hot chestnuts, and ale. There hadn't been a frost fair on the Thames since Sebastian was a boy. In his memories, it loomed as a magical thing, a marvel of music and laughter, and fanciful sights that seemed far more exciting than those of more humdrum fairs such as Bartholomew's or Southwark's. He supposed the wonder had something to do with the frost fair's ephemeral spontaneous nature, as well as the inevitable spice of danger that came from knowing the ice could at any moment crack and give way, plunging everyone into the frigid waters below. There were tents for drinking, eating, and dancing, toy stalls and skittles alleys, even a Punch and Judy show, and near the roasting sheep, a couple of apprentices were helping their master set up a printing press in a booth decorated with gaily coloured streamers. The apprentices were unknown to Sebastian, but he recognised the printer. It was Liam Maxwell. A young mother and two small children, all wrapped up warmly against the cold, were picking their way across the ice toward Maxwell's booth. For a moment, the younger boy paused to gaze in wide-eyed wonder at a juggler tossing flaming torches high into the air, and Sebastian found his thoughts spinning away, inevitably, to Jane Ambrose's last days. He suspected that near the end she must have felt something like a juggler herself, desperately trying to control the dangerous men who threatened her world. One of them had eventually killed her. If Sebastian could figure out how and where, it might tell him which one. But at the moment, his thoughts were all up in the air, going round and round in an endless, useless whirl. He was still staring thoughtfully out over the growing fair when a slim, elegantly dressed courtier came to stand beside him, the breeze rising off the ice to ruffle the artful curls that framed his handsome face.
"A curious level of excitement, this," said Peter van der Pals, his gaze on the bustle below. "One would think they've never seen a frost fair before. They don't happen here often."
Van der Pals shifted his posture to lean one hip against the snow-covered battlement and face Sebastian.
"I'm told you've been making inquiries about me. I have. I don't appreciate it when people lie to my wife. The Dutch courtier stiffened. It was considered a grave insult calling a gentleman a liar.
I beg your pardon?
Sebastian kept his voice even and pleasant, his gaze on two men setting up a swing below.
When you claim Jane Ambrose was jealous of your attentions to Lady Arabella, that was a lie. Her anger was actually provoked by your attempts to convince her to spy on Princess Charlotte. When she refused, you threatened to make her sorry if she told anyone. But she did tell someone, and now she's dead. All of which makes you a prime suspect in her murder.
A weak sun peeked out through a break in the clouds, and Van der Pals's eyes narrowed against the glare off the ice.
No one murdered Jane Ambrose. She slipped and fell.
Someone certainly made a rather clumsy attempt to give that impression.
So you're suggesting... What? That I killed her out of spite? For daring to tell some dried-up old spinster on me?
The Dutchman gave a ringing laugh.
Surely you know that everyone around Charlotte spies for someone.
Perhaps, except that as a result of your rather crude overtures, Jane Ambrose learned a certain troublesome secret about the Prince of Orange. And that secret gives you a second, and considerably more powerful, motive to kill her.
The smirk remained on the courtier's face.
Do you realize how many men in England, not to mention on the continent, know this supposedly powerful and dangerous secret? Yet no one is killing them. To my knowledge, Mrs. Ambrose's death remains a singularity.
Jane Ambrose's access to Princess Charlotte was also rather singular.
Van der Pals twitched one shoulder in a dismissive gesture.
At this point, it doesn't matter whether Charlotte learns the truth or not. It's too late for her to back out.
Perhaps.
But it does rather beg the question. If your prince is certain of his future bride's constancy, why were you so eager to place a spy in her household?
Security.
There are those who would like nothing more than to see the betrothal ended before it is announced.
Oh,
such as Charlotte's mother, the Princess of Wales, obviously, and those who champion her cause, namely Wallace, Broome, you know as well as I with whom Caroline associates.
Who else?
The courtier raised one haughty eyebrow.
How would I know?
Because it's your business to know.
Sebastian studied the courtier's handsome, smiling face.
The betrothal's announcement is being delayed, because Orange fears he has yet to adequately solidify his position in the Netherlands. That tells me there are forces within your own country that are as opposed to the match as Caroline and her associates. So who amongst the Dutch in London might be working to prevent the alliance?
None, to my knowledge. Apart from which, why would any of them want to kill Jane Ambrose? The woman was against the betrothal herself.
So she was.
Although I wonder how you came to know that.
She told me.
Oh?
When did she tell you this?
The last time I saw her.
Which was when?
You seriously think I recall?
You claim to recall what she said.
Van der Pals pushed away from the balustrade to stand with his hand dangling loosely at his sides, his chiseled jaw set so hard he was practically spitting out his words.
That makes twice you have insulted my honour by calling me a liar. It is only my respect for what is owed the dignity of my prince that prevents me from calling you out here and now. But I will not be so forbearing next time. Good day to you, my lord.
And with that he strode off, the hem of his elegant caped greatcoat flaring in the icy wind. After he had gone, Sebastian remained on the bridge, his gaze on the makeshift booths and tents below. Of all the Whigs gathered around the Princess of Wales, Lord Wallace was probably the most likely to stop at almost nothing if he thought he could scuttle the projected alliance between Britain and the Netherlands. But did that include murdering a talented pianist?
Perhaps. The problem was, why?
In what way could Wallace have seen Jane as a threat to his machinations?
J.
Jane was every bit as opposed to the proposed Orange marriage as Wallace. Vescovi had hinted at something hidden, something sinister. But what? What? Playing a hunch, Sebastian drove to Lord Wallace's house on Mount Street. Only instead of knocking at his door, Sebastian stayed with the horses and sent his tiger, Tom, to question his lordship's house servants and grooms. Unassuming, subtle, and beguilingly cheerful, Tom was very good at eliciting information without raising a whisper of either understanding or alarm. Sometime later, Phineas Wallace was crossing the snowy forecourt of the House of Lords when Sebastian fell into step beside him.
"Now what the devil do you want?"
demanded the Baron as they turned onto Margaret Street toward Whitehall.
"I'm wondering where you were the afternoon and evening of Thursday, the 27th of January." "Really? Why on earth would you want to know that?"
"That's the day Jane Ambrose was killed." Wallace drew up abruptly and swung to face him.
"You can't be serious."
"I'm afraid I am." When the Baron continued to simply stare at Sebastian, he said again, "So, where were you?" Wallace turned and kept walking.
"You think I remember? That was a week ago."
"Not quite. As it happens, Her Highness the Princess of Wales gave a dinner party that evening. All your friends and close associates, Broom, Whitbread, Earl Grey, were there, but you weren't."
"Why was that, I wonder? And before you claim to have been at home, I should warn you that your servants say otherwise." "My God, have you stooped to suborning a man's own servants?"
"Not suborning, merely questioning." Sebastian studied the Baron's tightly held face. "It's no secret that you are strongly opposed to the marriage Prinny has arranged between his daughter and the House of Orange." Wallace threw a quick look around and lowered his voice.
"Of course I'm opposed to this ridiculous alliance. But what is that to say to anything?"
"I don't think Jane Ambrose came to see you about music lessons for your daughter. I think something else was involved. Something linked to either Princess Charlotte or her mother, or both." Lord Wallace paused at the curb.
"Did it ever occur to you that you were wrong? That Jane Ambrose simply slipped on the ice, hit her head and died? That her death, while tragic, is not part of some grand and nefarious international conspiracy?"
Sebastian shook his head. "Jane Ambrose didn't die alone in the middle of Shepherd's Lane."
"That doesn't mean her death necessarily had anything to do with the princesses."
Wallace turned his head to stare thoughtfully up the snowy street, his eyes narrowing against the glare.
"I'm told Jane Ambrose was as much against this marriage scheme as anyone. If you are right, and she did not simply die by accident, then I suggest you look for her killer amongst those dedicated to seeing the alliance go through, not amongst those who are opposed to it."
"Perhaps, except for one thing."
"What's that?"
"Jane Ambrose would never do anything that might harm Princess Charlotte."
"Can you say the same?" "Don't be ridiculous," scoffed the Baron, and walked away.
But Sebastian noticed he didn't deny it. Chapter 37. That evening, Sebastian and his Viscountess wrapped young Master Simon in a fur-lined robe, sturdy boots, and a thick woolen cap, and mittens, and set off to visit the Frost Fair. The fair was a magical place after dark, with torches flaring up golden bright against a clear, glittering black sky, and strings of coloured lanterns dangling between parallel rows of makeshift booths and stalls. They dubbed the main thoroughfare the City Road, a grand promenade that snaked down the frozen river from Blackfriars to London Bridge. Scores of tradesmen whose businesses were suffering from the cold and snow had seized the opportunity to reach new customers, with everyone from barbers to shoemakers setting up shop on the ice. There were gaming tents with EO tables, Wheels of Fortune, and Rouge et Noir, drinking tents where gin and ale flowed freely, cook stalls selling mutton pies and baked potatoes and gingerbread, and amusements such as knock-em-downs and merry-go-rounds for the children. Their shrieks and laughter echoed across the ice, mingling with the wail of bagpipes, the screech of fiddles from dancing tents, and the quavering voices of ragged little girls singing ballads for a penny. Rather than being smooth, the icy surface was rough and undulating, for the Thames had not frozen in a single sheet. And so the streets of the fair twisted this way and that, winding around jagged snow-covered hillocks formed by the massive ice chunks that had floated down from upriver and collided into one another, allowing the river to freeze between them. Liam Maxwell's booth was only one of half a dozen or more printing presses operating on the ice, although his appeared to be the most popular, thanks perhaps to the doggerel verse printed on his cards. "Amidst the arts which on the Thames appear, to tell the wonders of this icy year, printing claims a place that at one view erects a monument to it and you. You who walk here and do deign to tell your children's children what this year befell, come, buy this print, and it will then be seen that such a year as this hath ne'er been." Sebastian handed over his shilling for a souvenir card.
"Clever."
"Thank you," said Maxwell, pulling the devil's tail on the press. Unlike the more sophisticated presses in Somerset's publishing house, this one was made on a wooden frame with a simple platen and rounce handle.
"I need to ask you some questions. It's important," Sebastian added when the printer kept his attention on the press.
Maxwell hesitated a moment, then signalled one of the apprentices to take his place.
"You've discovered something?" he asked,
wiping his ink-stained hands on a rag as they stepped away from the booth.
"Nothing definite, unfortunately. But I am curious about something. When I asked you what Jane might have been doing in Clerkenwell the day she died, you said you had no idea. Why didn't you tell me she taught piano to William Godwin's daughter? Surely you knew."
Maxwell frowned as he stared at one of the booths on the far side of the row.
"But Jane's lessons with Mary Goodwin were on Friday afternoons, not Thursdays."
"So they were," said Sebastian, following Maxwell's gaze to where Hero had paused with Simon before a display of colourful whirligigs.
"How much did Jane tell you about her last lesson with Anna Rothschild?"
Maxwell turned his head to fix Sebastian with a hard, steady stare.
"You asked me that before, and I told you she was upset to lose Anna as a pupil." "She didn't say anything to you about secret gold shipments?"
"Gold?
You can't be serious." "I wish I weren't."
"Bloody hell."
Maxwell kicked angrily at the loose snow at his feet.
"I knew she was keeping something about the incident from me. I even tried to press her on it more than once. But it upset her so much I gave up."
His eyes narrowed.
"Are you telling me that Rothschild had her killed? Because she somehow found out about his bloody gold smuggling?"
"You know about that?"
"Oh, I know. Don't ask me how, but I know. Only Jane didn't tell me, if that's what you're asking."
Maxwell threw another glance at Hero and lowered his voice.
"He was watching her, you know. Jarvis, I mean. Had his men following her for weeks before she died. I thought it was because of Princess Charlotte, but now I wonder. Jarvis says he didn't kill her."
Maxwell made a disbelieving noise deep in his throat.
"Well, he would say that, wouldn't he?"
Sebastian kept his gaze on the younger man's face.
"Do you know why Jane went to see Princess Charlotte's mother the week before she died?"
Maxwell's gaze met his for one telling moment, then slid away.
"Jane has knew the Princess of Wales for years. Most people think of Caroline as half mad and half foolish. But she's actually a very serious, accomplished musician. That doesn't explain why Jane went to see her, doesn't it? I rather thought it did." "Yes and no. You told me Jane was upset over Charlotte's betrothal to the Prince of Orange. And no one is more opposed to the Orange Alliance than Caroline and the Whigs who championed her cause."
Maxwell snorted.
You think the likes of Broom and Wallace have championed Carolyn's cause? I'd say they simply use her to advance their own causes.
Perhaps, said Sebastian, but that doesn't alter the fact that both Carolyn and the Whigs are united in their opposition to this marriage. So I can't help but wonder at the timing of Jane's visit. Did you know one of Orange's courtiers tried to get her to spy on the princess for him?
What?
Maxwell's mingling of shock and outrage were too visceral to be anything except genuine. She didn't tell you that, either. Maxwell's jaw tightened.
No.
No, she didn't.
He rested his hands on his hips and stared off to where a group of ragged boys were playing a game of football on the far side of the crowds of merrymakers, thronging the rows of tents and booths. His features were drawn and hard with thoughts and emotions Sebastian could only guess at.
Sebastian said, "You claim you want to help catch Jane's killer, but there's something you're not telling me."
Maxwell silently shook his head, but he didn't deny it.
"Has a date been set for her funeral?" Sebastian asked. "Tomorrow at St. Anne's, Soho."
"Ambrose didn't tell you?"
"No, he didn't."
Maxwell's lips tightened into a sneer.
"He's already let it be known that if I dare show my face there, he'll have me thrown out." "He's aware of your friendship with Jane." "How could he not be? Christian and I have been mates since we were at school together."
"Will Ambrose allow him to attend the funeral?"
"Christian?"
"I've no doubt Ambrose would like to keep him away, but it wouldn't look good, would it, barring Jane's brother from her funeral? And Ambrose is all about being seen to do the right thing."
"Mr. Maxwell," called one of the apprentices, "we need more paper."
Maxwell cast a quick glance back at his booth.
"I must go."
"Of course," said Sebastian.
"Thank you."
Sebastian was still standing there, watching the printer bustle about preparing a new ream of paper, when Hero walked up with Simon, clutching a square of warm gingerbread in his mittened hands.
"Do you believe what he told you?" she asked quietly.
"Some of it," said Sebastian, his gaze still on the printer. "But not all."
As they turned to leave, Maxwell stepped in front of his booth to clap his hands and shout,
"Step right up, friends, and seize your chance to support the freedom of the press. After all, what can be a greater example of liberty than a genuine souvenir of the Frost Fair printed right here in the middle of the Thames?"
They drove home through nearly deserted streets that glowed a ghostly blue-white in the waning moonlight. "What do you think Maxwell is hiding?" Hero asked suddenly, as if she had been quietly pondering his recent conversation. Sebastian shook his head.
"I wish I knew. I'd also like to know how the devil he found out about Rothschild's gold shipments and Jarvis's involvement in it all. He claims he didn't learn it from Jane, and that's one of the few things he said that I'm inclined to believe."
"Yet he didn't know about Jane's problems with Van der Pals."
"Evidently not."
Hero stared out at the shuttered shops of Bond Street flashing past. It was so cold the fresh layer of powder squeaked beneath the horse's hooves.
"You think Maxwell and Jane were lovers?"
"I'm not sure. He knew her lessons with Mary Godwin were on Friday and not Thursday, which is interesting, given that her own husband claims to be ignorant of her students. Of course, if..."
He broke off as the coachman shouted, "Whoa, there!" and the carriage came to a shuddering halt, the horses snorting and plunging.
"What the devil?"
said Sebastian, leaning forward. A man lay crumpled at the turning into Brook Street. A lanky, middle-aged man, with a long red scarf that trailed behind him like a line of blood in the snow. Chapter 38. By the time Sebastian reached him, Valentino Vescovi was struggling to prop himself up on his elbows, his breath coming in short, painful gasps.
"Where are you hurt?"
said Sebastian, kneeling beside him in the snow. The Italian's harsh features contorted with pain.
"Bastardo,
stuck a knife in my back.
Who? Who did this?
Don't know. Couldn't see.
Most of his face was hidden.
Sebastian looked up to find one of his young footmen staring at them, his mouth slack with horror.
Don't just stand there, damn it. Run to the house and get some men to help carry him inside.
Yes, yes, my lord, stammered the footman, and took off running.
Vescovi coughed, and Sebastian carefully eased one arm beneath the man's shoulders to raise his head and support his weight.
Why would someone want to kill you?
I was coming to see you. Tell you about the letters.
Vescovi's eyes started to slide closed, and Sebastian tightened his grip on the man's shoulders.
Hold on. As soon as we get you into the house, I'll send...
But Vescovi's eyes were no longer sliding closed. They were still and staring, and Sebastian knew he was dead. Sometime later, Sebastian stood with Sir Henry Lovejoy at the snowy intersection of Bond and Brook Streets.
A second of Princess Charlotte's music instructress found dead in the street, said Lovejoy, his shoulders hunched against the cold as he stared down at the dead man in silence.
Why?
I wish I knew.
Lovejoy shook his head in bewilderment.
The palace will never be able to quiet the speculation this time.
That doesn't mean they won't try.
No, said Lovejoy with a sigh. No, it doesn't.
They sent the harpist's body off to Paul Gibson's surgery. Then, at Sebastian's suggestion, they took a couple of Lovejoy's constables and went to search Valentino Vescovi's room at the Percy Arms in Red Lion Square. The innkeeper muttered and grumbled about being dragged from his fireside for something that could just as easily have waited until morning. He was still grousing about being disturbed when he threw open Vescovi's room. Then he broke off to clutch at his nightcap as it started to slide.
"Merciful heavens," he said, his voice rising into a squeak. "What is this?"
The room had been ruthlessly searched, the mattress dragged from the bed and slit open, drawers emptied and their contents strewn about the floor. Even the Italian's spare clothes had been slashed, as if the searcher thought something might have been hidden in their seams and linings.
"Whatever were they looking for?" said Lovejoy, pausing in the doorway.
Sebastian went right to the Italian's harp. The instrument's beautifully worked frame had been hopelessly smashed.
"I've no idea."
They searched the room themselves anyway, on the off chance Vescovi's killer had missed something in his haste. They found nothing. Wednesday, 2nd of February. Dawn was spilling a weak golden light down the snowy canyon of Brook Street when Hero came to stand in the doorway to the library, a cup of tea held in one hand.
"Did you sleep at all?" she asked Evelyn.
He looked up from where he leaned against his desk, staring at something in his hand.
"A bit."
"Liar." He gave a lopsided smile and set aside whatever he'd been holding. "What's that?" she asked.
"Jane Ambrose's locket."
"Ah." She came to hand him the cup.
"Here, this is for you. Drink it."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Can I talk you into some breakfast?"
He took a sip of the tea and grimaced.
"Not hungry."
He pushed away from the desk and went to stand at the window, his gaze on the long icicles that glittered in the cold sunshine.
"What in all of this am I missing?"
He brought one clenched fist down on the windowsill.
"Bloody hell, I still don't know where she actually died, how or why she burnt her fingers, or even who raped her a day or two before she was killed. Something must tie it all together. And now Vescovi is dead, and it's damnably hard not to hold myself in some measure responsible."
"Why?"
"Because you underestimated the importance of the communication between Princess Charlotte and her mother?"
Devlin nodded.
"And yet I can't think of anything that could be in the letters Vescovi carried that would motivate someone to kill over it. What could Charlotte have said? That she regrets allowing her father to trick her into this betrothal? That Caroline is working with her Whigged friends to find a way to stop it? None of that is exactly a secret."
"No,"
she agreed. But why else would someone kill Vescovi? Sebastian drained his tea and set it aside.
Damned if I know.
An hour later, Sebastian received a note from Cat Boleyn, telling him she had found Edward Ambrose's mistress. Her name is Emma Carter, said Cat. Is she in Sebastian?